You are listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network. I'm Dan Gould. Andrew Windham is the director of the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities and creator and executive producer of the national weekly public radio program Backstory with the American History Guys. He also executive produces With Good Reason, a public radio program that features teachers and scholars from Virginia's public colleges and universities. Mr. Windham spoke at the Wednesday, August 13, 2014 meeting of the Senior Statesmen of Virginia. The meeting was held at the Senior Center in Charlottesville. Following the presentation, questions were taken from the audience. The program was moderated by SSV Vice President John McCauley. Our podcast is entitled The Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. Here's John McCauley.
Well, I would like to introduce our speaker today. We have a good summertime program, I think, something that certainly can be informative and holds the potential of being educational for us. Andrew Windham comes to us from the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. He's the Director of Media Programs. For those of you who did not get our newsletter or see the newsletter, I will reiterate some of that information that was there about Andrew. For those of you who read that, forgive me, but I'd like to go ahead and, for the record, review that that introduction. Andrew is the creator and executive producer of the national weekly radio program Backstory with the American History Guys. He also is an executive producer with Good Reason, a public radio program that features teachers and scholars from Virginia public colleges and universities. And Andrew has created and executive produced other radio projects and initiatives. For those of you who may not have heard Backstory or had that privilege, I certainly encourage you to listen to it. You can get it on the internet. It is very educational. It's a history lesson in many respects, and a lot of the information presented can go back as far as the colonial period in America. So it really gives you a good overview of some of the important topics to our country and the history behind them. Andrew is the coordinating administrator and fundraiser for Backstory. He's responsible for hiring and for personnel and programming oversight and evaluation. Proposal writing in support of the project, distribution and promotion, communication with media consultants, press, and cooperating organizations and agencies. He's very, very much involved, very busy in that respect. He works to guide the development of the program with an eye to broad issues of mission and accessibility. And with a national consultant, he coordinates Backstory's promotion to stations. And he works with staff to support the development of digital strategies. He also manages Backstory's live programming and other special events. Andrew developed and served as project director for the 2003 Reimagining Ireland International Conference and Festival, which featured more than 130 scholars, journalists, politicians, artists, and citizen activists from Ireland. This program, which was opened by then-President Mary McAleese of Ireland, won the 2004 Helen and Martin Swartz Prize, awarded by the Federation of State Humanities Councils. Andrew also executive produced and directed the nationally and internationally broadcast one-hour Reimagining Ireland video documentary and edited Reimagining Ireland, a collection of essays published in 2006 by the University of Virginia Press. He conceived and organized the 1996 International Conference and Festival Irish Film, A Mirror Up to Culture, which was opened by Ireland's Minister for Arts and the Culture, Michael D. Higgins, who's now President of Ireland, and featured 40 Irish filmmakers, writers, and scholars. And for 14 years, Andrew coordinated the Southern Humanities Media Fund, which supported outstanding documentary films and radio programs in the Southern U.S. He earned his BA degree with honors from Washington and Lee University and an MA in English from the University of Virginia, where he also has pursued his doctoral studies. Now, the emphasis on Ireland comes no accident. Andrew was born in England of Polish and Irish parents, but he lived in Ireland from the age of five until coming to the United States at the age of 13. So, and I understand he frequently revisits Ireland, so he should have a good background on Ireland. So, with no further ado, let me go ahead and introduce to you Andrew Wyndham, and let's welcome him to the Senior Statesman.
Whew. Well, God, I feel exhausted just listening to all of that. It sort of seems like it must be about someone else. But I'm delighted to be here with the Irish Mafia, John McCauley and John McGrath, and thank Jim Peterson very much as well for all the help he's given me in getting this technical functions of the talk underway. I am the executive producer of Backstory and helped and created it, and so my talk is going to be a little bit biased. It's about the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. If you read the promo, there's a title. It's the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, or What is a Humanity Anyway? And I'm going to talk about that for a little while in a few minutes. But first, what I want to do is to give you, and of course this has gone off, come back. Okay, it's back. I want to give you a little kind of humanities nut to chew on, and that comes in the form of an excerpt from
the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. This is Backstory with the American History Guys.
Welcome to the show. I'm Brian Ballow, and I'm here with Ed Ayers.
Hi, Brian.
And Peter Onus with us.
Hey, Brian. We're going to start the show today with a little bit of poetry.
From December 15th, 1768.
This is Sarah Hand Meacham, an historian at Virginia Commonwealth University, and she found this poem published in the Virginia Gazette.
And I've pulled a section here for you.
This poem was allegedly written by a woman in memoriam of her pet named Phil.
Then did I stroke him, scratch his head, and in my bosom made his bed. For my affection was and still is all engrossed by charming Phil. But he is gone, ne'er to return, and unless 'tis to sigh and mourn, I'll therefore seek another pet. A husband I may surely get.
Whoa.
Lucky guy.
You might be wondering, what kind of pet was Phil?
So she's lamenting the death of her squirrel. Squirrels were the fashionable courtship token. Powhatan Robertson left us a very nice diary from 1816 when he was a student at the College of William & Mary. And he writes in his diary about sending Miss N, a young woman who was interested in, a pet squirrel and being very pleased when her family allowed her to accept it.
There were advice pamphlets on how to care for squirrels. Young boys would catch squirrels and tame them to sit in their shirt pockets. People would stand for portraits and be painted, yes, with squirrels. And so the obvious question for Meacham, why squirrels? I mean, why not rabbits or ducks?
Well, I think 18th century people read animals in ways that we just don't anymore. So a squirrel in particular, because of the patience required to get the meat out of the nut, was an emblem of diligence and patience. And so these were, you know, sort of aspirational virtues that people had for their children. So they liked to give children these squirrels so that they would, too, become patient and diligent.
I wanted to ask you a bit about the training part of the squirrels. Was there anything more than training up a trinket to give to the girl you were interested in?
I think so. I think much like today, how parents give children pets, hoping it will train them to some sort of responsibility, that was part of why pets were popular in the 18th century, particularly among sort of elite or white colonists, that it was a way that parents were training children to take on their adult roles. And some of these adult roles are very distasteful to us now, and correctly so. So some of these Virginia children would grow up and become masters and mistresses of enslaved men and women. By capturing a wild animal and domesticating it and taming it, the boy got some practice in the way he would be restraining humans later on. And girls, when they had to accept these animal gifts and keep the animal alive, showed that they would make good mothers and good mistresses. So it has a dark side.
Ed, it sounds to me like it would have been really pretty tough for people to meet their matches back in the period that you were talking to Pam about.
Okay, that actually is from a film, a program called The Beasts Within on pet ownership in American history. And we'll come back to it. As you can see, it's kind of fun, but it also takes a look at something very serious, or at least touches on it, and the examination begins there, but continues in the rest of the show. Back in the mid-80s, I had been working for the Virginia Foundation for a long time already, and Roger Mudd joined the board. I don't know if you all remember Roger. Yeah? Okay, so he was sort of used to fill in for Dan Rather, and then when, fill in for Walter Cronkite, excuse me, and then when Walter was leaving, there was a big, big struggle within the network as to who would succeed him, either Dan Rather or Roger, and of course, from my point of view, they made the wrong decision. But Roger joined the VFH board sometime after that. He went on to PBS, and at his very first board meeting, and I was considerably younger than I am now, obviously, and he sat down beside me at the board, on the board table, and he leaned over to me at one point and said, Andy, he always called me Andy. So we're all about the humanities, right? What is a humanity, anyway? And I was kind of flabbergasted. What is a humanity? He said, yeah, humanities is the plural of humanity. So what is a humanity? And this became one of his favorite utterances at board meetings. That and no. He became known as Dr. No, actually, for the tough questions he asked, and he was always a lot of fun. But I carried that question with me to today. And so what I'd like to do is to talk a little bit about the nature of the humanities and try to give an answer that I wish I could have given back then. I think that humanity, the word humanity, has to do with an implied contract that we all share that's based on an implicit or assumed trust as we move forward together in life. And we're always asking questions and giving answers about our humanities. We're always talking about that implied, mutually understood, sometimes violated contract. But we don't just go around asking questions whether this is our being good in relation to humanity or bad in relation to humanity. I mean, sometimes we do that in different ways. But it sort of is like the atmosphere around us. It permeates our everyday life. For example, you're assuming right now that I'm not going to pick up this computer and throw it out there on the floor or throw it at somebody in the audience. And if you were, you probably wouldn't be sitting there. You would have gotten out of the way. When you're walking down a street, and I'm not going to pick it up and throw it out in the audience, by the way. When you're walking down a street and you meet somebody coming around a corner, you may be startled by that, but you assume, despite some kind of subsidiary fear, maybe a little trepidation, that they are not going to pull a knife out of their pocket and stab you. And if you felt that they would, you probably would never even be walking there, or you would be carrying your own knife ready to defend yourself, or you would be running like heck in the opposite direction. So what I'm suggesting is that without a shared sense, that we can both be trusted, you and me, you and I, we really couldn't get on with anything. We couldn't begin our lives. We couldn't be sitting here together because we couldn't be certain of what the person next to us might be about to do next. We assume that on the basis of our shared commitment to acting in kindness and in care, or as though the other were us to ourselves, we assume that we can go on in life. But we all come at this essential humanity, and we all come out of this essential humanity in different ways, okay? So we all come bearing our unique experiences. I mean, you all know that. We're affected by our upbringing. We're affected by whether we were happy or we suffered as we were growing up. We're influenced by the conventions of culture. Like, should you be free to talk about your feelings in a social situation? When somebody asks how you are, what do you say? I'm doing really well today, thank you. You probably don't go into the depths of what you were thinking earlier in the day, or you may not. Is it okay to explore your feelings about sex in public? Some people think yes, some people think no. Some people are more comfortable than others with that. Perhaps you have had to put a premium on self-protection as you were growing up, or perhaps you've been encouraged all your life to move forward in trust. And you look at yourself as not just providing for yourself, but as providing for the welfare of others. So if I have a lot of food, but I know what it means to be hungry, and I know that it could happen again, that is, that I could be hungry again, what am I going to do if I know that you are hungry? What am I going to do? What is my obligation to you? What is your responsibility to yourself? Should others in the community have a role in helping the two of us to sort that out? Should the government act in place of the immediate exercise of our choice, or act for individuals to help out and provide support to those in need? Should it do so if they are ill-equipped or unable to do so for themselves? But what if, in effect, they refuse to do so, even, that is, to take care of themselves, even if they are able to do so? Now, my point here is not to talk about charity. It's to talk about responsibility. And it's not to talk about the welfare state either. It's to talk about our responsibility to humanity. The issue here, for me anyway, and this, by the way, is not the official doctrine of the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. It's the official doctrine of Andrew Wyndham. So don't tell anyone, okay? So the issue is that when you go just a little bit beyond the essential and normally implied contract of our humanity, and you add in the complex experiences that everybody brings to everyday relations and that are inevitable, then questions about our nature and behavior or humanity in relation to each other can become really puzzling and even confusing, very complex. Enter stories. Welcome stories. Welcome the way we use stories to explore questions about our humanity and to give us perspectives on possible answers. We tell stories and use them as accounts to search out the meaning of our and other people's behavior, to look at attitudes from which behaviors come and the possible consequences that arise from behaviors. How do people's commitments to kindness, how do people's commitments fear of betrayal, how do violations of the assumed contract between us, because we all know they happen, how do they affect our trust and play out in the future? What do people's choices in a complicated world spell out for our well-being generally, for our happiness, for our suffering? Because of their experiences, people see things deeply, and their choices often become a topic of wonderment. We're united in our hopes, but we're divided by conditioned attitudes and patterns of thinking, the patterns of thinking that they entail. And the big question is, can we overcome these? Stories are all about this kind of human complexity, I think. They're about this aspect of humanities. They concern how we work toward or fail at making peace with our basic shared sense of the common good, the wish we all have for kindness and for care. And stories are essentially about the nature of humanity and all the imponderables and ponderables this entails in real life, or as it plays out day to day. Okay, we all want to figure this out. We all have questions about it. We try to interpret and understand what is going on in the stories of our lives. And the humanities are the various ways we formally express our sense of and explore our humanity. Take that, Roger Mudd. The humanities reflect on and they ask questions about, they offer perspectives on, and they sometimes expound theories on what we all at some level intuitively know is good for us as human. They focus on what allows us to continue and working and living together. And in this sense, the humanities, you probably are all thinking this in the back of your minds, intersect with religious meaning. Though they make religious meaning an object of study and not a commitment as such. The humanities play out in many fields of expression. Telling stories is their basis, but interpreting the facts that go into the making of stories is their daily bread. They ask about what is good for us, wrong with us, and at least implicitly, they look at and feed our common humanity in terms of the choices we do or could make. They talk about those choices. Now, poems and plays, Death of a Salesman, Hamlet, novels, Middlemarch, Ulysses, The Heart is a Lonely Hunter, may all provide perspectives on choices that confront us as humans, but puzzling out the why of stories is the stuff of the humanities. And they also focus on the how of the why. That is, on how do we make sense of meaning and what is meaningful to us in relation with each other. That's philosophy. They also deal with the record and interpretation of past actions. That's history. They also dig up remnants of ancient cultures and cultures that were trying to strive for greatness and who were also trying to deal with issues of humanity together, and that's archaeology. Or they asked about the structures and rules of a culture, whether it's okay for me to say, yeah, here or not. I mean, don't let that go out of this room, okay? He said, yeah! He sounded like Howard Dean. Well, okay. They look at those structures within our cultures and they ask, what is okay? This is sociology and it also becomes anthropology. These are all parts of the humanities. So the humanities are all this stuff in academic fields that have to do with humanity and interpret our humanity in various fields of knowledge. So it's about a bunch of eggheads off in libraries and dimly lit rooms, working on their computers and researching and exploring. And the big question is, so what? How does this get out in the world? How does it make a difference? How does it influence people? How does it improve people's lives? Well, another ba-ba-ba-ba. Welcome the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. The Virginia Foundation was planned to work in the world outside universities, but bringing perspectives of scholars together in dialogue, either directly or indirectly, with people throughout our state and, in fact, now beyond our state. It was developed to support people's interests in understanding and exploring what we value, which finally is our sense of how to work happily together. How our values are expressed or compromised as we address conflicts or as we try to overcome challenges, how we result to ourselves and become fixed in our ways as we exercise our attitudes, all these are part of the humanities and the humanities exploration. And that all sounds like pretty serious stuff. But it actually can be a lot of fun. And that's what I hope that first clip began to suggest to you. In fact, it can be downright entertaining to do this stuff in your life. And one of the VFH's, Virginia Foundations for the Humanities, main goals is to provide the support for people to come to terms with tough questions. We had a woman on our staff who developed a program or a book, a periodical called Tough Times Companion. And it was filled with literature of people who had struggled to survive in various ways and was brought together to share with other people who were struggling to survive in similar ways. Well, we try to create accessible means for people to do this, to reflect on and discover our shared humanity and to brighten their own lives. We have various programs that do this. One of them is the Virginia Folklife Program, and God willing, this is going to work. Looks like it is. Bop, 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 bop. Oops.
I don't know why it should be, but lately I can plainly see.
Oh, yeah.
You're cruel to me. Do what you want to do, but darling, all I ask of you is put me down easy. Put me down easy, baby. Oh, don't make me suffer.
White kids at that point started switching over to WRAP and WHIH, so they were listening to it. They couldn't get it that much on the white stations, but they were already crossing over. It's just that they couldn't get the bands.
Yeah,
it was almost a no-brainer, you know. And then these kids are going, "Oh my God, he's fabulous! Yeah. Oh my God, you know, there was a soaking it up, you know."
Well, that's rock and roll, isn't it? I mean, white kids listening to black music.
Yeah, man, it was a wild party.
A guy and a girl on a motorcycle.
They rode the bike into the frat house, went up the steps, down the other side of the steps, and the girl got off the motorcycle, and both of them were buck ball naked. Man, I have never seen nothing like that, man. I was shocked because she got on the stage. I was singing a song by Sammy Dave, "Hold On, I'm Coming."
Uh-huh,
yeah. And I looked over, that's a...
They were so popular, so big, that everybody wanted them. So there's a country club that was very, very restricted. They didn't want any blacks, they didn't want any Jews. None. So when she called the book. She said, well, we really want the band, but can you stay home?
Oh,
she
no. Can you stay home?
Yeah, can I stay home? I said, okay, well, we booked the band. I knew damn well I wasn't going to stay home. It sounded like fun to me.
Yeah.
What's really interesting to me is you had all of this assimilation. You had whites listening to black music. You had whites and blacks together making the music in many cases. But at the same time in Norfolk, you were also having these incredibly divisive social issues relating to race. Who knows if that ever carried over into the music. It doesn't look like it did, but there were, you know, it was a pretty heady time.
This is a 3-minute clip from a film by being developed by the Virginia Folk Life Program, which is in the works right now. This is sort of a promo about Charlie McClendon and the kind of music that was being played in general in Tidewater at the time. And so, again, it's about humanity. And it's about trying to make dialogue about humanity accessible and appealing. So we're always trying to do that. We do radio programs. We do videos like the one you just saw. We support exhibits. We support reading discussion programs. We just support multidimensional conferences that may have discussion panels and musical events and theater and dance. And we hope that people are going to use all of these media, these mechanisms, if you like, to venture answers, ask questions about how life works in our culture and society generally, how their own lives work, the kind of choices they've made, how they've made sense of things, and acknowledging in the course of that that things change, people change, things get lost, and that things get passed on. VFH looks at all these kinds of things. And we go way back into the past sometimes to explore what we've lost and how this happened.
But I'm curious to know what it would have been like even earlier. Peter, could you give us a sense of how people actually met each other, met their future husbands and wives back in the 18th century?
Well, Brian, I think the short answer is they were virtually born knowing them because they came out of small village communities, a lot of face-to-face transactions, and you wouldn't want to marry a stranger. You'd want to marry somebody of your own faith, somebody who you could rely on, somebody you had learned was trustworthy over an entire lifetime. So it's familiarity that makes the kind of courtship that we're talking about in the 19th century unnecessary.
Yeah, so a totally different world.
Yeah, it really is. But that doesn't mean that important things weren't happening and changing in the world of courtship, precisely because that kind of image I gave you of static, intimate village society is radically transforming in the late colonial period.
You wouldn't be willing to tell us about that transition, Peter, would you?
I just might. Let me start by talking about premarital pregnancy rates.
Premarital pregnancy?
You know, well, the number of women who came to the altar already pregnant. Now, this is scandalizing you. This is not the story we like to tell about the good old family values in old New England.
What were the numbers like?
Well, if you go from the 1670s, now this is the baseline for you in the Puritan period, the heyday of Puritan theocracy, if you will, the rate is something like 2%. It's trivial. But those rates have skyrocketed to 30 or 40% by the 1770s.
40%?
Yeah, yeah.
This is not the 1960s you're talking about.
No, I'm talking about the 1760s, believe it or not.
Unbelievable.
Wow.
But we shouldn't reach the conclusion that this high rate of premarital pregnancy meant the end of the family as we know it, mm-hmm. and lots of children born outside of marriage, because most of these premarital impregnations led to legitimate children. That is, the brides were pregnant, but they had children within marriage.
They got in under the wire.
Yeah. But a lot of these pregnancies are a result of parental-sanctioned interaction between boys and girls. And by that, I mean the custom of bundling.
Bundling?
Bundling is a traditional custom that comes from England in which young people who intend to marry eventually will spend the night together in the home of the young woman. In theory, is not supposed to involve sexual intercourse, because bundling means that you're semi-clothed and that you're lying there together. In some cases, there's a little piece of wood between you, or in one amusing case, they promise to put a Bible between them. But you get carried away. You go too far, as we would say. That's not the end of the world. Ordinary folk expect this to happen, and they, in fact, think it's a good thing. Because the important thing is family formation. That's always the goal of courtship. So how are you going to guarantee that a family will form and that your daughter won't be seduced and abandoned? That's the great, great fear of the late 18th and early 19th century, is seduction. And of course, the testimony of neighbors and witnesses is crucial if it ever came to court.
So, Peter, this is really kind of the first bait and switch. The guy thinks it's about not having sex, he has sex. But that's not what it's really about. It's the parents don't mind the fact that families are being produced. What it's really about, the switch, is keeping that guy there.
Yeah, exactly right. I've got a great big bundle of love,
full of kisses that'll see you.
That's a backstory episode, are you reflecting in your own grandchildren or lives? I don't know. But in any event, we have two radio programs at the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. The other one is With Good Reason. And I want to continue giving you these tastes of the kind of things that the humanities do by giving you a quick excerpt from With Good Reason.
Sarah McConnell, and this is With Good Reason.
Cold cake, cod, clams, against their wish, do it. Even lazy jellyfish, do it. Let's do it. Let's fall in love.
Wow. It's kind of funny, but almost every time I eat a good oyster, I think, gosh, that's better than I've ever had.
It's Jonathan Swift who gets credit for the line, "'Twas a brave man indeed who ate the first oyster." And for most of us, you either love him or hate him. Poet Nikki Giovanni of Virginia Tech, on the other hand, ate her first oyster as a child, and she still indulges.
Oh, my. I love oysters. They have not made the oyster that I don't love. I really like them raw, and I really like them with just a little bit of pepper, and I like a little lime on mine.
You're not the only oyster in the stew.
The Dean of Southern Cookery, Edna Lewis, penned an essay describing how food is intertwined with the seasons and cultures of the South. Here's Nikki Giovanni reading a portion of that essay.
Southern is a delicious oyster stew of sautéed oysters, cream, sherry, salt, cayenne, fresh ground pepper, sassafras, a spoon of butter in the bottom of the bowl, and a garnish of chervil.
Americans consume about 100 million pounds of oysters each year, which we eat raw, smoked, baked, fried, roasted, steamed, canned, even pickled and stewed. We visited with the celebrated chef Craig Hartman to learn his favorite way of preparing this luscious food. And as we stood in the big commercial kitchen, we discovered that Craig Hartman and oysters go back a long way.
my great-grandfather was an oysterman on the Wicomico River. You know, my first book that I read about food as a child that my mother gave me was called Consider the Oyster by M.F.K. Fisher. But I remember she says there were three kinds of oyster eaters. There's the person who likes them anyway, cooked, raw, steamed, baked. Then there's the purist who eats them only raw. And then there's the person who eats them only cooked. So I think I'm the first. I like them anyway. They're so versatile. But
So this is a program about the community of oystering, about the changes in that oystering community over time, and very much about how people gather together to eat together and to share the delights of a particular food that they love and that becomes a form of bonding for them. So I'm going to talk now a little bit away from radio, but I want to tell you about a conversation I had. This was a few years ago. There is a national meeting every year of humanities councils. The Virginia Foundation for the Humanities is a state humanities council. And at that meeting, there's always a few cocktail parties and reception type things. And so at one of those, I was talking with the director of the California Council for the Humanities. And he had had a few drinks. And so he was a little bit more ready to say things than he might otherwise have been. And so he said something like, "Hey, Andrew, the VFH has so many agendas. You take so many different approaches to communicating with people. How can it work? And really, what do you think you're doing? There's no coherence or logic to your program." Well, I was a little older than I was with Roger Mudd, so I did have something to say to him. But let me tell you first that there are 50 state humanities councils. The VFH is obviously one of them, but there's nobody else like the VFH. And I can give facts to support that statement. The average budget of a state humanities council around the country is $1.3 million. For the last 3 years, the expenditure budget of the VFH, based here in Charlottesville, Virginia, has been between $5.7 and $5.9 million. We, the VFH, and really, when I say we, it's us, because this is Virginia's program. It's for Virginia, for the people of Virginia. We have 13 major programs. Most state humanities councils have between 2 and 4. We have, as you just realized, 2 radio shows. Most humanities councils, there isn't a single other humanities council that produces its own radio show, which we do. So back to this California director and his challenging observations, which were really kind of his asking, on the one hand, how you do it, and on the other hand, it was kind of an administrative judgment against what we're doing. And he was saying it's not really a very good idea what you're doing. It's too diverse, it's too unfocused, you're doing too many things for too many different people. And my response was something like, well, if we can make it work, and if we can reach people wherever they may be using the web or listening to radio or watching films or going to conferences or going to exhibits, then it's all to the good. And I might have added, but I didn't, that we, the VFH, is trying within its limits to offer an embracing sense of what humanity means for people in the general public. And we're giving people the opportunity to assess the nature of the humanity in their own lives. The VFH has been doing this, has been making this happen since 1974. We're actually in a year-long celebration of our 40th anniversary right now. And it's been 40 years since Rob Vaughan, who is still president of the VFH, traveled the state with Edgar Shannon, visiting small communities, holding workshops, and saying, we're thinking about starting a state humanities council. Do you think that's a good idea? What ideas do you have for us? What do you think? Want to be part of this? And the VFH started in that year with just a grant program, giving out money in response to proposals coming from local communities all around the state. And we've become a lot more than that. The organization has grown enormously, but we still value tremendously those grants and their effects. Along the way, since 1974, the VFH has had a whole swath of tremendous projects that I could tell you about in detail, and I'm not even going to try. Some of you may remember the Virginia Women's Cultural History Project. It was started with Linda Robb and Helen Bird, so it had bipartisan support. And it was a series of discussion programs and forums on women's history in Virginia that was held throughout the state over a year and a half period. There was a film produced. There was a tremendous exhibit, a traveling exhibit, that began at the Virginia Museum of Fine Arts. And there were all kinds of ancillary publications, including a fabulous catalog that came out of it. We also did an international conference on the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom about a year or so after that. We did a series of statewide discussions on the Supreme Court, the Bill of Rights, and the law. John mentioned Dahlia Lithwick coming next month. Well, what we were doing is we were going out into communities with case studies of actual Supreme Court cases focused on the Bill of Rights, and having people read those and talk with scholars and debate their meaning and their and really their sense of what was right or wrong in the decisions that were being made and in what was going on in their communities. The foundation started the Book Festival, the Virginia Festival of the Book, now, which just had its 20th year. We started a resource center, a humanities center that distributed film and video all around the state when it was too expensive to buy and there was no Netflix. Nobody had even thought of Netflix. And out of the Humanities Resource Center came a center for media and culture, and ultimately we began to produce our own radio programs. We created a fellowship program which provides support for scholars all over the Virginia, but also all over the country and the world even. We've had scholars come from Greece and from Australia and from China to do work that will ultimately speak to people out in the community in some way. And as John mentioned, we've had a couple of Irish conferences. I'm proud of the fact that, and I'll tell you, I'm not going to tell you about the conferences. That would take too long. But the first one was opened by Michael D. Higgins, who is now the president of Ireland. And the second one was opened by the then president of Ireland, Mary McAleese. So we've had two Irish conferences in Charlottesville. Who would think that we would have an Irish conference in Charlottesville? Neil O'Dowd, who is the owner of the Irish Voice in New York, said, it shouldn't be there. This is a New York event. And I said, no, it's actually a Charlottesville event. And people came to think that. They came to feel that they had come to this community, meeting primarily with our people, although we had people coming from all over the country and from Ireland itself to the event. But it was like a sanctuary. It was like a safe place for a lot of difficult conversation about globalization, about religious difference, about wealth and poverty, that occurred over a four-day period with a great deal of other kinds of entertainment. So, in brief, what has happened since 1974 is that the VFH has created a kind of a kaleidoscope of programs and initiatives that all, we hope, support the effort to give people the means to make sense of our common humanity. And we have a design for all of this. That guy from California was wrong. I'm not sure if it's an intelligent design, but we have three divisions. One are community programs. The second is digital programs. The third is scholarship and education. And under those, each of those, there's a bunch of smaller programs. Under the community programs, number one, there are grants. There's folk life program. There's an African American history program, which is doing wonderful work around the state. There's a Virginia Indian Heritage program, also a fabulous program. Someone I spoke to before the event started told me she had was here today in part because she had attended some of Karen Wood's either talks or classes, lectures, I'm not sure which. The book festival is in that portion, the community programs, and the VABC, the Virginia Arts of the Book Center, which is a relatively small program, but it is a place people can go to learn letterpress printing, that is setting type and actually making beautiful volumes and writing their own text and coming away with it. Okay, the second division, the encyclopedia, an online encyclopedia, which I'll tell you more about, and Documents Compass, which has been a huge program to annotate and digitize founding era documents. And they're moving on probably to do the papers of Dolly Madison next. And then the third division, and when I said maybe intelligent design, it's called Scholarship and Education, and it includes Backstory and With Good Reason, two radio programs, and it includes the Fellowship Program, which of course is clearly for scholars. But With Good Reason and Backstory also involve scholars. But all of these divisions overlap because community programs are also drawing on scholars, and scholarship and education programs are also digital. Radio gets distributed in digital forms now. You all have the newsletters, so I'm not going to hand those out. It's written here, give out newsletter. please take your newsletters with you, and I hope you'll read them. But this is the universe of the VFH. And if you're interested in really learning about the individual programs, on October 2nd at the Jefferson School, there's going to be a 40th anniversary celebration. And every one of the programs, you're welcome, every one of the programs is going to be represented there, have a table, have people who can talk with visitors about what's going on. What I'd like to do is to give you a little bit more of a sense of a few of the programs. And the first one, when you heard grants, you probably lit up inside momentarily. The grants are relatively modest, I should tell you, at the moment, probably between $5,000 and $7,000 is now a big grant, although they used to be a lot larger. The grant program has experienced some very painful federal and state cuts over the year. But I'll just tell you about a grant project. It's a film. It's a film that is called The Old Belt. And actually, now is the time when I should start to, if you can excuse me for a moment. Okay. You know, I could put that full screen, but I'm a little... Jim told me to put it full screen. Okay, Jim. Full screen, yes. Okay, I may have to go out of that. But anyway, Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, you can see yours truly standing there. The grant program. Okay, the grant program has deadlines twice a year. and they are listed there on the screen for you. They're in October and April 15th. But the film I was going to talk about is called The Old Belt, Down in the Old Belt. And it deals with bright leaf tobacco culture in Virginia, in the Halifax, Pennsylvania area, with sort of Danville as its epicenter, since the mid-1800s up until around 2005. And it was developed by a guy, a cultural geographer who lives in Roanoke, Jim Crawford, a wonderful person. And he developed this with the idea that what happened in 2005 was, or 2004, I guess, was that there was a federal buyout that ended price supports and the allotment system. And so the local tobacco culture in Virginia began to die out. And he conceived of this program as not a pro-tobacco or anti-tobacco, but a kind of a balanced opportunity to hear from the people speaking about their lives and their changing way of life in their own voices. And the VFH put the first grant into it. It wasn't a huge grant, but it enabled Jim to get going on it. Well, when it premiered, it showed on 150 PBS stations. The General Assembly, or the Generous Assembly, as they occasionally are, decided there was a joint resolution in the General Assembly of congratulation and celebration for the completion of this film. And the city of Franklin actually was inspired to begin work on a peanut film, a film about the changes in peanut culture in their own community. So this is the kind of thing that happens through the grant program. A small grant, a seed money grant, is provided that allows people, gives people an endorsement, gives an organization an endorsement, and also allows them to move forward with the work, ultimately gaining the larger money that they need to make it happen. And over time doing this, the VFH has reached every corner of Virginia with literally tens of thousands of individual events in thousands of grant programs. And the great thing about the grant program is it's not coming from the VFH, it's coming from the ground up. People are bringing their own ideas, often ideas we have never thought of, to the table and saying, hey, this needs to be done, this is important, our communities are interested in this, can you help us make it happen? And that's what we do, if we can. Another example of this would be, there's a communications faculty member now of the University of Richmond, but she used to be at VCU, named Laura Browder. Well, she was developing a film on impersonators, slippery characters, and on Asa Carter. And she came to us ultimately asking for support, but she began working on this in book form as a fellow in our fellows program. She was then a guest on With Good Reason. She then became a speaker at the book festival. And finally, she asked for a grant, and she received it, and she produced the film on slippery characters. And again, it was a film that cost actually hundreds of thousands of dollars, but the VFH helped to get it started. Second, the Folklife program. We've already talked a bit about the Folklife program, at least indirectly. The Folklife program is run by John Lohman. The grant program, if you ever want to approach the grant program, is run by David Berenger. The Folklife program is a statewide program. It every year has an apprenticeship showcase right here in Charlottesville. This year it's on September 23rd. And one of the things that happens every year is there's a huge vat of Brunswick stew that they make, and the other people make biscuits, and there are a lot of beans around. And anyway, there's lots to eat and there's lots to drink, and the apprenticeship program of the Folklife program organizes this. And that's what I really want to talk about, is the apprenticeship part of this. I will mention that John does festivals everywhere. The Richmond Folklife Festival, he plays a major part in. He plays a major part every year in the Folklife Festival that the Smithsonian does. He's done a number of CD series, one on the music along the Crooked Road in Virginia. And he's done films, including the one that he's working on right now with his associate on Charlie McClendon that we saw a little excerpt of earlier. What's happening in the Folklife Apprenticeship Program is that people are being paired up, young people, who are often already very skilled in a particular folk tradition, a craft or a musical skill or a vocal skill, and they are paired with master craftsmen. So I'll give you an example. This year, the Holmes brothers, there they are, who come from Christchurch on the Middle Peninsula, and are National Heritage Fellows, they've just been named National Heritage Fellows, they've been singing together for 50 years. They are doing an apprenticeship with two people. One is an 11-year-old girl who writes her own music and is already very skilled. And one of the cool things about the Holmes brothers is that they mix traditional gospel music with R&B and jazz, which used to be an absolute no-no. In fact, it's still frowned upon in some circles in the African-American community, but they really go for it. And and they're doing that fellowship or that apprenticeship. Another apprenticeship was done by a woman some years ago named Flory Jagoda. Flory is a Holocaust survivor, and she came from Sarajevo in Bosnia, where her family was one of the premier musical families. And she escaped, and she plays the accordion. She calls it the harmonica. She calls it a harmonica. And she's just turned 90 and actually hasn't played in decades now. So what's happening this year in the apprenticeship program is that one of the apprentices, or one of the master artists, excuse me, is an accordion restorer, an accordion rebuilder. And John saw Flory's accordion in her house up on a shelf, and it's all cracked and worn out, basically. And he has taken it, and they are going to be presenting Flory with a re-energized accordion on her next birthday, they hope. When Flory was a fellow, we also did a little radio piece on her, and I'd like to play you that now. This is Flory's story. And we could have the lights on if you would like. Thank you.
Flory and I have had a lot of conversations, and often in the beginning she would say, you know, well, you don't want to hear about this. But the more we got to know one another, the more the stories started coming out, such as this one about her escaping on a train when the Nazis first occupied Zagreb. One of the themes running through her stories is the accordion. She calls it a harmonica. That was her first instrument, and it's always with her. And in this story, she really credits the accordion with saving her life.
The majority of Zagreb people say, oh, it's never going to happen here, come on. But it happened, you see. My father came to me one day and he said, we have to leave. We cannot leave, all three of us together, because the street you went to the railroad station, Jews couldn't walk. And anybody who sees you, if they know you, you're Jewish, you're finished. See? So he said, we'll have to just live separately. He arranged with my neighbor's maid to take me to the station. And he told me, don't open your mouth. Don't open your mouth. Play your harmonica. We call it harmonica, accordion. Just sit and play. Play all the lessons you already had. Just keep on playing. So she brought me, I had my ticket, put a babushka on, and my accordion, and got in one of the compartments. You know, compartments in Europe, how they have closed the door and you're with six people, okay? And I sat there and started playing my accordion. And people kept on coming. It was filled up right away. And here, they love music, you know. I'm playing all little folk songs, you know, no big deal. The conductor comes, he sits down, he sings with us. And I kept on playing from Zagreb to Split. I think it's a four-hour ride. Chocolata y bombonicos, dos chapeos y jugueticos. The beauty of harmonica is that you can hug. I mean, you were tense, you know, you were tense, scared to death, away from your parents, alone. So I really hugged that accordion. And that, I really could say, saved my sanity.
Flori was, in fact, only one of a few members of her family to survive the Holocaust. She's been through all sorts of horrors in her life that we couldn't even imagine. Yet there's something in her music that is so incredibly joyful. I think it's really a testament to what the arts can do for the human spirit.
Floyd.
So, I have about probably 15 minutes more of, really, and the best is to come yet, but how are you all feeling? Do you want me to continue for another 10, 15 minutes, or would you like, what I would tell you about is a little bit about the Virginia Festival of the Book, a little bit about With Good Reason, and play you a little bit more, and a good bit more about backstory with the American History guys, and give you some more samples of that. But I know this is a long talk, so what do you think?
Yeah, let's keep going. Yeah, I think our cutoff is 3 o'clock. We don't want to go beyond that. But we do want to give you a chance to ask questions or make comments of what Andrew's given us. I don't want to miss that opportunity. Some of these things he's mentioned, he could cover. If you have questions in that regard, we can get those answered. So if you have a question or want to make a comment, please wait until we bring you a microphone, because this is recorded, and we will have to pick up your comments.
I didn't know that.
No offense. All right, so let's maybe pause right here and then see if you do have comments or questions. I think this has been very informative. I hope we've learned a lot about the foundation, and I hope we can pique your interest to explore it even further. If you have a question, just raise your hand.
So, and I'll only take questions about the Festival of the Book, Encyclopedia of Virginia, With Good Reason and Backstory. Because those are the things I was going to talk about. No, I'm just kidding you. But there's more to play and to show, and I'm sorry that we don't have the opportunity for that. But do you have questions? Go on.
Yeah, go on about the Festival of the Book.
I'm being told to go on about the Festival of the Book.
That's my question, since I don't know anything about it.
Okay. All right. So, I shall do that. Okay, well, the Festival of the Book takes place every year in March. The next one is March 18th to 25th, 2015. And you know, a lot of the promo about the festival has to do with how many programs there are, whether it's 225 or 250 in a particular year. It runs over 4 days, and there are as many as 20,000 audience attenders over those 4 days. The festival has had an extraordinary run of participants, including a whole series of poet laureates, including Rita Dove, Natasha Trethewey, Robert Pinsky. But one of the things that the festival does sort of behind the scenes that I just wanted to mention, and that the director, the new director, Jane Kulo, who took the reins from Nancy Damon, who retired after 14 years, one of the things they're particularly proud of is that they have 61 events, or did this year, in schools and classrooms. And these are private events for the kids in classrooms, and they're not really seen. Here you have Lois Lowry, who's the author of The Giver. It's coming out as a movie. She's a two-time Middlebury Award with some of her fans in a local school. And so it's a great opportunity for the kids. Among the events in the preceding year, in 2013, was an event called American Icons. And Congressman John Lewis appeared there with John Carlos. I don't know how many of you know or remember John Carlos. He was a track and field star and a football player who, at the 1968 Olympic Games, raised his fist in a Black Power sign and created a great deal of controversy, and then went on to win a couple of gold medals. So these men had never met before. They are people who had showed a lot of courage in their own lives in the face of a lot of outrage, really. And they talked about the history of the civil rights movement together. Another example of a really terrific book festival program took place in 2011. And I'm sorry, this is John Lewis and John Carlos on stage with Robert Vaughn, who is our president at the Culbreth, I believe. And in 2011, best-selling author Catherine Stockett, she's the author of The Help, came here. And she came really, this was before the movie The Help had come out. She came as a result of the Grishams. Renee Grisham brought her to John's attention, and then they sort of came to the VFH and the foundation and worked out with us an opportunity for her to be here. And in a ballroom event while she was here with iced tea and cookies, she read some of the 60-some rejection letters that she had received for The Help before it became a New York Times bestseller and went on to become a movie. And then I'll just give you a brief look here. This is Catherine Erskine, who's a local National Book Award winner, who is interviewing Lois Lowry, who you saw earlier with the kids. So the next book festival coming up in March, please be there. The next program, EV, Encyclopedia Virginia, this is their home page at the moment. They are trying to do a really comprehensive history of Virginia online. It's a wonderful, wonderful research tool, but an educational tool as well. And basically what they're doing is they're providing a place for people to explore what they think they knew about Virginia, but really they don't or didn't. And Matthew Gibson is the lead person at the Encyclopedia. He's the managing editor. And he was telling me, I said, so what should I talk with the group about? What should I tell them about? I mean, give me a story that you think is something people wouldn't have known about. How many of you know about Henry Box Brown? Good. Ooh. be frightening if you all raised your questions, your hands. Well, he was a slave in Louisa. He lost his wife and child. And in despair, he left in an inventive but a really pretty terrifying way. He was mailed upside down in a box on a train from Richmond to Philadelphia that took 40 hours to get there. And he survived to tell of it. And you can read about his life subsequently if you go to Encyclopedia Virginia. There is actually a bronze replica of the box on Canal Walk in Richmond. Currently, right now, with the help of NEH support, we're focusing on Reconstruction and slavery. That is, the EV folks are. Next, they're going to be looking at the Revolution and the Early Republic, and they've already pretty well done Pre-Contact and the colonial era. They're also working on something called Digital Virginia. You may have gotten the idea, as you've been listening, that VFH produces an awful lot of media. And some of those were produced in very old forms, on VHS tapes, on U-matic tapes, on Hi-8 tapes. People don't use them now, and the machines aren't available for them. So what we're hoping to do is to create a DV, a Digital Virginia archive, that will house all of these materials plus similar materials in digital form, cataloged to be readily accessible online. And this is a major project that the Encyclopedia is working on right now. They also have tremendous media throughout the site. Without going online, I can't really show you that. But what I did do was bring an example of, they were approached by Google. Have you ever seen the Google Street View maps that are used, and you can kind of, you know, turn all around or look where you're going? Well, the guys at the Encyclopedia and gals, women, thought, wouldn't it be great if we could do this at historic sites? So they have started to do that throughout Virginia. One of the ones they've completed is at Poplar Forest, Jefferson's home near Richmond. And this is not a real example because it's... This is when he didn't want to be at Monticello. And if I can just hit this. It should start to move. This is as though someone were navigating around it, but it's actually a filmed version, a recorded version of what you can do. So one of the many media, and there are all kinds of wonderful illustrations in the Encyclopedia that Matthew has really intensely focused on, is to develop wonderful Google Street Views for historic sites all over Virginia. I'm almost there. Two more to go. I'll escape from this. Escape. Okay, sorry. All right. I've played you a couple of clips from With Good Reason. With Good Reason is a program that features, or has featured for many years, the faculty at Virginia colleges and universities that are state supported. It's now moving out beyond that, and there are guests from all over the country in series like a recent series that they did, 10 parts on science, technology, engineering, and math programs, particularly for economically disadvantaged kids around the country. They recently did a wonderful documentary called Messages from a Forgotten Troop Ship. It was featured in the Washington Post. And I'm going to go back quickly to here. Oops. And go again current slide. And there you have the homepage of With Good Reason, withgoodreasonradio.org. Here is With Good Reason's wonderful host, Sarah McConnell, who is a brilliant interviewer and has a signature voice that you're almost certainly familiar with, and you'll hear it in a few minutes. This program I just mentioned, Messages from a Forgotten Troopship, is based on audio that Vietnam vets or participants in the conflict who didn't live to become vets sent back to their loved ones. And I have about a three-minute cut. I don't know if you would like to hear it or not at this point. Do we have time, John or Jim, or should I go on? We have 3 minutes? Okay. Well, okay. So,
isn't it funny all the things I want to say? And I love you. I just do. I'm fine. I'm still in one piece. I still have all my arms and legs and hands, and I still have my voice, and I thank something, honey. I don't know if I thank God. I don't know if he'd hear me, if he's there. But I just thank something. I'm gonna be all right. I think I'll sing.
Prison that has held me for so long. I would fly as one just promised all the riches of a song. I would stay on one bended.
Jeez, when was it? I think it was January of 68. My friend and I bought a car, a 62 Valiant. And we just went up and down Highway 1, and we just lived in the 62 Valiant. My friend, she had grandparents who lived in Riverside. And so when we took off, my mail was sent to her grandparents in Riverside. They lived in a trailer, and I walked up to the trailer after we had opened the gate, and she was driving the car. And I said, hey, I said, did I get any mail from Augie? And her grandfather was very old, and he said, Augie, isn't that the boy who was killed in Vietnam? And that's how I found out my mother had sent a telegram there. Anyway, that's how that happened.
No, I love you. No, I care. I'll see you soon, really. It's getting shorter. Shorter. Yet it's a lifetime. But I am coming home to you. You'd better believe it, woman. I told you I'd never leave you alone.
I'm 66. Augie died just before I turned 21. And, you know, he's part and parcel of my life. He's helped make me who I am. And, it's just so wonderful to hear his voice. And I love his last words, I am never going to leave you alone. Which has turned out to be true.
Okay. With Good Reason has won all kinds of prizes, including, I think it's now 5 Gabriel Awards, and Murrow Awards and the Associated Press Awards from the Virginia Association of Broadcasters, excuse me. Okay, I'm now at the part, backstory, that I spend most of my time on currently and was planning to talk about at some length, but I'm not going to do that. I've played you excerpts throughout it, throughout this talk, I will say that Backstory is a national weekly public radio program that links present and past. Our motto is, your past is about to catch up with you. And it is now broadcast in 101 communities in 23 states. It's currently being featured on iTunes on a banner on their podcast page. And this is our home page. This is the banner that is currently up there on the on iTunes for the Corruption Show. There are a very wide range of programs that the three guys, Ed, Peter, and Brian, to whom you've been listening, do. There recently have been shows on water in American history, on fashion in American history, on corporations in American history, on civil rights, and of course, many others. WAMU in Washington has just moved Backstory from 6 a.m. Sunday mornings, where we actually were beating every other station at that time, every other program in that time. It was the number one program with a record audience for the metro Washington area, to 2 p.m. Sunday afternoons in primetime weekend, just before On the Media. In Chicago, Backstory follows Car Talk and holds Car Talk's audience very well. The guys, you probably know them, Ed Ayers, who used to be dean of the college and the Graduate School of Arts and Sciences at the University of Virginia, is now president of the University of Richmond, and is soon going to be ending that phase of his life as well. Peter Onuf, who is the nationally known expert on Thomas Jefferson. Ed's area is 19th century, and particularly the Civil War. Peter was the Thomas Jefferson Memorial Foundation Professor of History at UVA. He's now emeritus, and he's a research fellow at Monticello. And Brian Ballow, who runs the National Fellowship Program at the Miller Center of Public Affairs and is also in the History Department. Well, these guys, with a tremendous staff led by Tony Field, who is our senior producer, who came to us from On the Media at WNYC in New York, are producing programs that are stronger and stronger and are getting picked up by more and more stations around the country. Our goal is to have Backstory become a household word, and it seems to be happening. We've been receiving wonderful support from audiences, wonderful support from funders. So that's basically it, except to play you one last clip from Backstory. It's a call. In Backstory, there are interviews. You've heard one of those. There are riffs that the guys do, and there are calls. This one is with Herbie from somewhere in Kentucky, and it's on guns. We did a show called Straight Shot, Guns in American History.
Historian Susan Rue has researched these letters.
And another call, guys. Herbie from Whitesburg, Kentucky, has got a question.
Well, I'm in the mountains of eastern Kentucky, and people have a lot of guns here. I mean, the women carry guns in their purses. The men carry guns in their pockets.
Right.
We have 24,000 people in the county, and I might be one of 100 who doesn't own a gun.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if there's some history of us being any different from any other parts of the country, but I don't know. From here, it seems that people really like their guns.
Do the other citizens of Whitesburg know that you're unarmed?
I don't announce it very much.
You just did. You realize
they think I was armed.
Well, you know,
do you know how many people listen to us in Whitesburg?
We got a fan club in Whitesburg. You are in trouble.
Oh, Lord.
Now listen. I'm from Upper East Tennessee, Herbie. This is Ed. So I'm from Kingsport, yep, the greater Tri-Cities metropolitan area. Mm-hmm. So I do understand. I know where Whitesburg is, and I know what you're talking about. And I think you see a couple of things. One, the culture really is very proudly around hunting. Is it not? Is there not lots of camouflage and lots of gun racks? I believe if you ask your neighbors, why do you have guns? Some of them would say to protect myself, but most of them would say, well,
I got it because I'm a hunter.
Yeah.
And this is a part of my tradition. It's a part of the culture of the mountains. It's a part of the culture of the South. You know, we've been doing this for, you know, my grandfather taught me this. I know gun safety. And it's just people who don't know guns who are afraid of them.
Yeah, well, my grandfather set me down at the age of six, and he says, okay, let's go out and learn to shoot. And it was just part of growing up, you know. That was one of the lessons of a young person in the mountains.
Yeah, it's part of the founding mythology of your part of the country, which is also my part of the country. Picture that painting of Daniel Boone walking down the Cumberland Gap, carrying a big rifle, right?
You got it.
Yep.
And he has to have it to feed himself, to defend against the Indians, and to protect his family. I believe that in an unbroken chain, in a way that no other part of the country can claim, that Southern Appalachia has an unbroken tradition of guns being necessary to sustain the kind of life, which is a fundamentally rural life in connection with the landscape, which involves hunting, that no other part of the country does.
Let me ask you another question, because Ed made such an eloquent case for the continuity of male gun ownership in his and your part of the country. I'm just curious to know if you agree with that. Do you think this is just something that has been going on in your neck of the woods, so to speak, in Kentucky for 200 years?
Well, what I believe is that there's more of a obsession with guns now than there was when I was young.
Yeah.
I really think people, for one thing, Walmart carries them.
Yeah.
You know, they're all, I mean, it's easy to get your hands on them.
Yeah.
And people like them. People just like to examine them and, you know, show their guns to other people and talk about them. And it's like a, I don't know, like a collector mentality partly.
Yeah.
Well, I think Herbie just made a better point than I did, so I want to build on it if I can. Even though there is a tradition of loving guns, the supply and the nature of those guns have changed continuously over those 200 years, right? So first, there are these relatively rare flintlocks that a family might have had really to have used quite irregularly in the off chance that it actually saw a deer
or some decoration over the fireplace.
Yeah, exactly. And then you would have seen those guns growing old and decrepit up until the time of the Civil War. The Civil War, now suddenly people have modern guns. They have rifles. Then the people start coming back from World War I with new guns, and the guns start being mass-produced. And I think they're one of the first things that people would have invested in that's mass-produced, to get a gun that you can really count on, because you still want to enact this old tradition of hunting for your food. And then, as you say, in the last 30 years, Walmart, Kmart, building on the old tradition of Sears, Roebuck, and mail order, and the result is a profusion of guns. A lot of people who would not have had it before, but who still feel like that they're doing something that's socially sanctioned. You don't have to be embarrassed at church if you have a gun, right? You don't have to feel badly if you have a gun in your car, because it's something that identifies mountain culture.
I remember when I was a child, my dad was taking the gun to work with him every day because the miners' strike was on and we didn't know what was going to happen. And I remember going in, I was a child, and I was going through the catalog, Sears and Roebuck, and it said, no guns for miners. And I thought it meant that none of the coal miners could get any guns.
That's great.
That's good. Herbie, this has been a wonderful call. Thanks so much.
Hey, great to talk to you all.
Thank you so much, Herbie.
Bye, Herbie.
Bye.
Thank you all so much.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.